everybody. Thanks to everyone who's joining us on this press conference. As Raju mentioned, the spelling challenge. My name is Rocco Galati. That's R-O-C-C-O-G-A-L-A-T-I. I'm the executive director of the Constitutional Rights Center. I also practice law with the Rocco Galati Law Firm Professional Corporation. The press conference today is, I'm glad it's happening, because earlier in the day, there was an attempted hack of our website, crash our website, and luckily did not succeed. For those who saw the notice of the press conference, you know that I'm acting on behalf of, my firm's acting on behalf of 15 active and 4 retired police officers. There was a typo on the press release that said 10 and 5. It doesn't really matter. The important thing is that we have 19 police officers who've stepped up. And on April 20th, we filed a challenge to various aspects of the COVID measures, which all hone in on what is expected of police officers and the impossibility and the constitutional violations that ensue. And that's why my clients have stepped forward to seek the clarification of the courts on their roles as police officers with these, with respect to enforcement of the COVID measures. Joining me in person to my immediate right is Julie Evans, and to her immediate right is Chris Vandenbos, both active police officers and who are 2 of the 19 applicants on the case. Now, I just want to give you some context of the challenge. You can read the actual document, court document filed, if you go to the Constitutional Rights Center website at Constitutional Rights, plural, Center, spelled the Canadian way with RE.ca. And you could read the challenge. I'm not going to read it at this press conference, although I will focus on 2 or 3 central passages of that notice of application to highlight why my clients are concerned to the point of stepping forward at their personal and reputational risks because of unwarranted and hostile and irrational reprisals that are floating around like a high wind in the COVID measure context. So anybody who dares speak out is ostracized and is attacked, even if they're doing so in a civil and appropriate way. Here are the basic problems. Number one, with the regulations and their enforcements. Firstly, many of these regulations are not specific enough. They're too vague and broad and aren't clear enough to enforce uniformly and fairly. So you get a wide range of actions being taken. And unfortunately, some of it is very hostile and violent on the part of the police, because they're not interpreting the actual regulation, but they're interpreting what the politicians and their supervisors think, often wrongly, what the regulations say. So you have written regulations, and then you have people like Doug Ford who talk out of their side and mistake the regulations. And a lot of police officers are getting their cue not from reading the regulations, unfortunately, but actually from the politicians and the supervisors who bring down the law as they see it. So what you end up with in that scenario is, number one, lawful police officer discretion on the streets of the officers who are to apply and enforce the law is being undermined and subverted and removed. Number two, for those police officers who've not bothered to actually read the law and are following the politicians and supervisors' version of the law, they're abusing their authority. And often, as you've seen in various videos, to violent and hostile ends, to unfortunate ends, whereby they're beating up on citizens in a park or tasering kids on a skating rink Why? Because they're taking their cue from the moron politicians and supervisors who haven't taken the time to read the law and realize this is not easy to enforce unless you want to make your own law on the spot. And that's not what a democracy is supposed to be. These regulations lead to police state and martial law measures. The second problem that goes to the center of the challenge is that, as the applicants see it, many of these COVID measures force these officers to breach their oath. This is an oath that includes upholding the Constitution. And I'd like to read a couple of paragraphs from the notice of application where this is key. This is where it ends up. A typical police officer's oath reads as follows. I solemnly swear or affirm that I will be loyal to Her Majesty the Queen and to Canada, and that I will uphold the Constitution of Canada. That's what they swear to do when they're appointed as police constables, right? And further, that I will, to the best of my ability, preserve the peace, prevent offenses, and discharge my other duties as police constable faithfully, impartially, and according to law. So my clients say that the enforcement of the provisions set out, and I won't bore you with the section numbers, pursuant to the Emergency Management Protection Act and Reopening Ontario Act, are of no force in effect and unconstitutional in allowing and being directed by superiors to violate a citizen's constitutional rights under the Constitution Act 1867, as well as the Charter, as follows. One, violation of freedom of expression, speech, association, assembly, and religion, contrary to those unwritten constitutional rights recognized by the Supreme Court of Canada through the preamble of the Constitution Act 1867 and Section 2 of the Charter. Two, violations of the right to liberty and security of the person through the arbitrary and unreasonable detention, arrest, and interference with the physical liberty and movement of citizens, contrary to the liberty of the subject under habeas corpus, as well as Section 7, 9, and 10C of the Charter. Three, violations of the protection against unreasonable search and seizure, contrary to Section 8 of the Charter. And four, placing police officers in the potential violation with respect to religious gatherings and services of committing an offense contrary to Section 176 of the Criminal Code. Many of these police officers that take it unto themselves to barricade and put an army line between a church and the street, and in fact walk into churches unannounced without a search warrant onto private property restricted to parishioners, are breaching 176 of the Criminal Code, which says it's a criminal offense to interfere with or stop a religious sermon or gathering. So the third major problem with these provisions is that the regulations are too vague and too broad to apply without breaching the constitutional rights of the citizen. So, you know, how do you ascertain if a gathering is social? How do you ascertain numbers without calculating space? You know, it's just unfathomable to actually give concrete precision to when, if and when to charge somebody without making up the law on the spot. And that's not the way the rule of law is supposed to work in our system. The law should be sufficiently clear. There are two doctrines. One is the doctrine of vagueness, and one is the doctrine of overbreath. If a law is too vague to apply, or if a law overreaches, those laws are unconstitutional under Section 7 of the Charter as being either vague or overly broad. All these regulations suffer from that, most of them, not all of them, but most of them. The fourth problem was the latest regulation which we challenged in this notice of application, Regulation 294/21. That's the regulation that allows the police to stop you without cause and compel information from you, ask you your name, your ID, your address and where you've been. And this amounts to no less than martial law. It is a police state provision. It's martial law. And one of the problems with martial law is that the province does not have any jurisdiction to engage in martial law provisions. If martial law provisions are to be implemented, subject to constitutional review and constraints, only the federal government has that jurisdiction under Section 91 in the preamble, the Peace, Order, and Good Government, or 91.7 for military matters. So the province can't impose, by way of cabinet regulation, martial law, including curfew, which is a stay-at-home order, and arbitrary stopping and detaining of citizens without any cause whatsoever. If that can be done, subject to the charter, that can only be done by the federal government. And I just want to read another portion of the notice of application with respect to these issues. So my clients in the notice of application seek amongst other things, the following three declarations. A declaration that granting police and other provincial officers the authority to arbitrarily stop pedestrians and motorists and compel personal information and data without any reasonable probable grounds of the commission of an offense are unconstitutional and of no force and effect in violating Section 7 of the Charter, liberty and the right to remain silent, Section 8 of the Charter, reasonable search and seizure, and Section 9 of the Charter, arbitrary detention, and thus compels the police officer to breach their oath to uphold the Constitution. Furthermore, that the bar of entry across, quote, provincial borders by residents and citizens coming from Quebec and Manitoba without probable grounds and offense being committed violates Section 7 of the Charter, liberty, as well as Section 6 of the Charter, which grants every citizen the free right, the right to travel as between provinces, and thus compels the police officer to breach their oath to uphold the Constitution, and further, that the OPP has no jurisdiction to set up roadblocks at Ontario's, quote, borders and refuse passage into Ontario. Under our legal system, we do not have physical provincial borders. This is just made up by Doug Ford and his Gestapo OPP. We do not have provincial borders. Borders are manned by the federal government as between other countries. And then thirdly, the measures and enforcement of measures as set out above constitute martial law, police state measures outside the scope of the province's jurisdiction. Now, I know what you're all thinking. You know that after Doug Ford enacted by way of provincial regulation 294/21, he came out and gave us his crocodile tears, disappeared, and you're all under the misimpression that he's not enforcing these regulations. So here's the problem, which is highlighted by what just happened with Ford and his lies, further lies to us. There's one, the law is set out in writing. He comes out and says, okay, sorry, we made a mistake. We're not going to do that. And all of you believe it. Well, the regulation has not been revoked. It's still on the books. And newsflash, part of the regulation is still being enforced at the borders. The OPP is stopping Ontarians from freely traveling in and out of the province. And I've had reports in my neighborhood that people are getting stopped after hours and being grilled on why they're not at home. So while he tells you with his crocodile tears, sorry, we're not going to do it, the law's still on the books and is being abused. And so this is why we've challenged this in the application that my clients have directed me to file. Now, As I said before, if you want to look at the notice of application, it's on our website. If any of you out there want to support my clients, because, you know, you must be thinking, boy, police officers must be rich to be able to go to court. They're not. You know, they're relying on fundraising efforts. We're going to go to court. We're going to take this to the end. But if you want to support this court application on behalf of these police officers who, during the normal course of their day, are out there risking their lives for you, and now they're risking their reputation and their careers because there may be reprisals, unjustified reprisals. We'll react with the full force of the law. If they're disciplined, they're fired for bringing this application. If you want to support them, go on to our website, constitutionalrightscenter.ca, and there's a specifically designated donation button called Police Action, and you could donate through that button. And so I'll open it up now to any questions that anyone has.
So we're going to take questions from the members of the press here first.
Yeah, actually, I'd like to address this to Julie and Chris.
Identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. David Menzies with Rebel News. Sorry. And I understand you are both active police officers. And as Rocco mentioned, you are facing potential repercussions, including termination. What is motivating you to come forward and literally put your careers on the line by putting a face to this application here?
Thank you. So I grew up in subsidized housing as a young person, and somebody in my family was disabled. So from a very, very young age, I learned to protect people. I learned to advocate. I learned the art of assertive communication. These things were key in order to grow up and have a successful future for myself and my family. Through those lived experiences, I was exposed to many, many different challenges and different vulnerabilities. And so I'm quite passionate about protecting those that are vulnerable or those that are marginalized or racialized and ensuring that their rights and freedoms are protected. That's why I joined a career in policing, was to protect people, to uphold those rights and freedoms and to make sure that nobody would ever take advantage of somebody's human rights. And so I've done that work in advocacy throughout my entire career, from fair and impartial policing to working in youth programs, to building community capacity, to creating opportunities for those on the margins that face issues of intersectionality to have those opportunities. So when I saw this legislation coming into play, I questioned it immediately. There was no doubt in my mind that it was an outright breach of people's charter rights and freedoms. I swore an oath. I grew up and had every vision of being passionate about protecting those rights. That has never changed. In my career, to stand with the citizens of this country to ensure that I do everything possible within my power, within the law, to ensure their rights are protected today, tomorrow, and for the rest of the future.
And my position is not much unlike Julie's. I come from a family that emigrated to Canada from Nazi occupation, and they came to Canada due to the fact that it represented freedom and rights. And when I had the opportunity to become a police officer in 2005, the amount of joy and pleasure and also pride that my family felt, coming from a policing family where my siblings are also on the job, there was a great deal of pride in taking that oath of service. And we were trained ad nauseum about the importance of maintaining the Charter of Rights and Freedoms at the police college. And that's something that I held near and dear in the application of my duties. And throughout the course of policing, we are exposed to a lot of traumas, and they take a great deal of mental effort just to get ourselves up in the morning to get to work at some points, and we see unfathomable things. Now, it's worth taking those lumps as a police officer, knowing that you're serving the greater good in your community, and upholding the rights and the freedoms of the people is, to me, first and foremost. And that's an oath that I took, and I stand by to my dying day.
and again to the active officers. If I may give you an anecdote, a couple months ago, oddly enough, a press conference given by Adam Skelly of Adams and Barbecue, a wife of a Toronto police officer recognized me, and she told me that in his division, half of the police officers are basically of the opinion, we did not sign up for this. We hate what we're being told to do. But the other half, they believe that they are indeed enforcing the law for reasons of public health and safety, and they are all in. I am curious, based on your colleagues, your brothers and sisters in the police divisions that you work at, is it a similar sort of split within divisions? And she also said this is creating considerable tension regarding those officers who really dislike what they're being told to do and the others who are totally invested.
Well, in regards to that, the divide that we're seeing is very visible. I myself have a lot of friends and family that are on the job, and the amount of feedback that I've gotten in regards to these measures is exactly that they have a real conflict of crisis or a conflict of character as well, because this is so important to officers for the most part to remain steadfast and adhering to their oath. And when they're being asked to not, that creates quite a bit of turmoil internally. And I can speak to that end that those officers have reached out to me as well and expressed that.
And would you say it's a 50-50 split, or would you have a different kind of ratio,
Chris? If it were to go by the people that are in my circles, I'd say it's above 50%.
Okay.
But obviously I'm not connected with every police officer, so I can't speak to exact numbers on that.
Okay. I wonder if you can comment on the internal kind of dynamics, also more from the sergeant level, and like how this is coming down from above.
I'm going to just leave that to the court application rather than giving anecdotal evidence. The court application asserts that there is supervisory pressure and coercion to apply the law in accordance with blanket orders. That's what the notice of application says. What people have to understand, and to David Menzies' question, we can't be surprised that there's diverging opinions in the police force, like every other sector of society. Police are human beings. What we are trying to clarify and expose is that there should be no division amongst Canadians, that we live in a constitutional democracy where the rule of law ought to prevail. But what you see out there in every sector, including the politicians and the police supervisors, is I don't care what the law is. I'm making the law on the spot. And you see that with Doug Ford, John Tory, Pierre Trudeau, right? They're speaking in doublespeak. The law says one thing, but they're interpreting and saying another. For instance, Doug Ford saying, if you walk into a store and you have a legal masking exemption, if the store owner doesn't want you without a mask, you're trespassing. Well, that's legally incorrect, right? So we have the premier subverting the rule of law by his reckless, stupid personal opinions. I don't know if he could pick up a law book up right side up, let alone conclude that. He hasn't read his own regulations. So this is the problem. Police officers in our legal system hold the lowest direct office to Her Majesty we know. They hold office like a cabinet minister holds office. Their discretion, once they investigate a crime on whether to lay a charge or not, is their discretion. Their supervisor can't direct them unless the supervisor was in on the investigation. They're being directed to just blanket zero tolerance application of laws that are very complex and very factually based. Second of all, politicians, you know, how often have you heard Doug Ford saying, I've issued an order? Really? You're that large that you issued the order? Like you know, King Charles the 13th or 14th, King, the kings of old? I would have thought your cabinet ministers, if they're properly applying the act, would deliberate and issue a regulation. But they all come out and saying, I've issued. Now listen to that. It's not insignificant. And so everybody's taking the law into their own hands. When police officers are exercising, after a proper investigation, their discretion to lay a charge or not, and against whom, part of the calculation under their oath is the Constitution. I mean, they can put in regulations that you're supposed to stop every black person you see however you like. And we know that's wrong. It's not any different with the COVID measures.
So, Rocco, if I may, you might be on the right side of this issue, but when it comes to your application, how hopeful are you of success? I mean, you are quite literally going up against the state. It's a Herculean effort, a state that has access to an endless trough of taxpayer dollars, whereas you have to fund this personally. What do you think the chances are of you getting a favorable outcome when this is heard?
I'll say the same thing I've been saying for 33 years of practice. I'm always going up against the state. I'm always, this is, for me, this is par for the course. That our chances of winning or losing are a complex question. Sometimes you lose the battle, but you win the war. Sometimes you just educate people. Sometimes you actually get judges doing the right and lawful thing. So for me, David, as much as it's, you know, it's nice to try to call the number on the wheel of fortune, I don't even think of what my chances are. All I do is I see something and I say, this has merit. This is legally and constitutionally sound. These people are right in law, and I'm going to pursue it. And I don't care how many idiot government lawyers or judges, for that matter, want to decide the other way, because they're all curling up in a corner in their diapers over COVID. The law must still prevail. The Constitution still has to prevail.
And if I may, again, to the officers, Chris and Julie, we have for a year now been covering the protest by, quote, Yahoo Nation, which was, of course, the slur Doug Ford gave to his own base in terms of standing up for their constitutional rights. And it was pretty much without incident until January of this year, where certain areas like Yonge Dundas Square, literally the public square, Nathan Phillips Square, became no man's zone. And we witness, and we have it on film, Canadians being arrested and thrown in a paddy wagon for waving a Canadian flag, for quoting biblical passages, for simply standing by themselves on a corner. I mean, I'm baffled by what the crime is being committed here. How does it feel to you as police officers upholding the law when you see this kind of, I would argue, infringement on citizens' rights when it comes to the right of assembly, free speech, protest, etc.?
I think the big thing for me is a lot of these folks are people that have been directly and negatively impacted by these measures. So these are people that have lost their jobs, that have not been able to pay their rent or pay for their mortgages, or they're lining up at food banks to feed their children. So I look at that and I say, these are people that have lost everything. They're suffering, they're struggling, and they're coming to a place to exercise their right to express that. So as an officer, to sort of criminalize that human behavior or that charter right, to me, is reprehensible and abhorrent, and certainly something that I would never do, nor would I engage in.
And a supplementary question to that, as I said, for months and months, these peaceful protests were tolerated, and then in January, different set of rules. Who's behind these rules? Who's in charge? Who's calling the shots right now, where suddenly, like I said, quoting a biblical passage or waving a Canadian flag becomes an arrestable offense?
I'm going to answer that. It's obviously the upper echelon brass and the politicians, certainly not the officers on the street. So, sorry, David, there's a couple of hands up, and I'd like to give them a chance to ask their questions.
So thank you.
There's Jason.
JC first.
Okay.
So, JC, I'm going to ask you to unmute yourself.
Yeah. Thank you. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My name is JC Moses. I'm with DDP Studios Incorporated. We make Thinking Fahan. And now I'm sorry to be irreverent if I, you know, I'm getting a little too, you know, because it's a very serious topic and a very serious issue. But
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that, JC. You said, did you say irreverent or sorry for being irreverent?
Yeah, if I'm going to be irreverent on a serious cause, like we're, you know, we're fighting a tyrannical government right now, and it seems like I'm trying to find humor in this. But I want to say, first and foremost, I want to say thank you so much, Chris and Julie, and also all the police officers, for your strength and tenacity and having the conscience to hold to your convictions, you know, on the Constitution of Canada. So my minstrel hat off to you. And but more seriously, I wanted to ask you, the because of the strength of the case, obviously, is the Constitution. But the strength of the case also could build on more officers actually, you know, piling up onto this, onto the case. Is there anything verbiage, any lineage or any kind of verbiage or phraseology, I should say, that we could use in order to try to convince these police officers? Because I talk to them all the time when I cover events, whenever it used to be events. But I'm pretty okay with it and speaking with officers. Like, is there something that we could pull their conscience with? Like maybe perhaps some momentous moments from the oath that is common amongst officers?
Yeah, JC, I'm not going to let my clients venture into those waters. This is a legal action in the court.
I'm just trying to encourage like the cultural part. Like, how do I convince other officers of the issue?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's something that's outside the scope of their role as applicants in this court challenge. Every officer, like every individual, has a right. Period. To think what they want freely within the bounds of the law. So we're not here to politic or lobby people who think differently from our clients. My clients simply represent that significant body of police officer who have a conscientious problem and a legal problem, a constitutional problem with enforcing these laws as directed by politicians and supervisors, which in turn breach their oath. Okay. So we're not here to convince anybody.
Okay, no problem. It's no problem. But Mr. Galati, I'm just inquiring about me, perhaps. How do you convince other officers then? What's the plan to convince other officers?
We're not here to convince other officers.
No? All right, so it's just the one case, and you don't want anybody else on it. Okay, good. Thank you.
I'm just wondering about the Scott from Internet News. I'm just wondering about the court case, and it's when it'll be seen and what the kind of where you see it in the immediate little future.
I'm sorry, who's asking the question?
Scott from Internet News.
What your
application and just like follow ups and like where you see it, when will you get a response from it? Or?
Well, once they send their notice of appearance, we've served the application today. Once they respond, and in the next several weeks, I'm going to be filing the application record and then asking for motion scheduling court to iron out a schedule and a hearing date. And I'm hoping, you know, by fall, we can be in court arguing this.
We have Jason next.
Jason,
you're on, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. If I could go back to Julie and Chris for a second, I wanted to ask how long did you deliberate making this decision, and was there a turning point? Was there a particular moment when you were convinced that this was the thing you were going to do?
I'm going to respectfully ask that not answer, because that's going to form part of the evidentiary chronology of the case, and I don't want to do this on this forum.
Okay, another question to Chris and Julie. I'll try again. You said, Chris, you mentioned that of your circle, it's about a 50-50 split of people who are in your camp and people who are sort of in the, I guess, Doug Ford or that camp. What do you expect to happen?
Okay, if you phrase it that way, Jason, I'm going to have them decline too. See, we're you know, the Doug Ford
camp. Do you anticipate any fallout from this decision? And are you concerned about that?
Well, obviously they've revealed who they are. So any concern that they have, they're here, and we'll deal with it if there is any inappropriate fallout.
All right.
Okay.
Well. Is there going to be someone else has a question? I'll try and think of another one.
Okay, you do your best, Jason.
Okay. Sure. Sorry, guys, just a quick comment. This is NSFIA from Druthers. It's a newspaper that's funded by the people, and it's actually came out at the protests. And so we have thousands of people watching right now.
Right.
And they're primarily made up of protesters. So it's not really a question. All I keep seeing is just how thankful these people are to you guys standing up. I know it could be a little bit concerning, of course, what you guys are up to, but there's going to be massive amounts of support, at least from what I can tell, for you guys standing up. And yeah, well, on their behalf, thank you. And thank you as well,
We welcome any support. I keep reminding people, you know, Chris and Julie are not alone. There's 19 applicants. There may be more before we get to court. We don't know. However, you know, 19 applicants stepping forward to go to court, trust me, as a lawyer, is not insignificant.
And how can people support the cause? Is there crowdfunding available?
You go to the constitutionalrightscenter.ca. Under the donate button, you will see a button that says police action. And if you want to support financially, and we welcome financial support, because they're going to throw everything at us in resisting this application, you just make a donation and it'll get designated to this action. Our center does is involved in more than one action. And so go to police action under the donate button. It'll take you to the donate page. And when you make your donation, on our end, it'll clearly say police action, and we segregate those funds for the police action. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, we have a question from the audience regarding why hasn't the public prosecutor or the police issued warrants for the arrest of the public officials that have broken the law, i.e. the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Ford and Tam, etc., should all have arrest warrants by now?
Yeah, you need to direct that question to whoever you have in mind should be arrested. I mean, simply put, I'm not a mind reader. I'm not clairvoyant. I'm overweight enough to look like a cheap fortune teller, but I can't answer that question.
Okay, we have JC wants to ask another question.
JC,
he's the Reverend JC.
JC, go ahead.
Hi guys. Yeah, no, I was just asking a question to your Rocco about, it's like, what can we do? Like, what can I do as a radio host? Like, that's what I'm asking myself to assist in this procedure. And I just find what I'm seeing right now happening to our constitutional rights, it really bothers me. And it bothers me.
Well, what you could do is read our notice of application.
I've seen that. But I mean, I'm as a comedian, dude, I influence people. I have a daily radio show and things like that. What can we say? What cannot we say?
You're free to say anything you want.
All right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I mean, you can spread the word that police officers of conscience have gone to court to clarify their role under
the law. Script.
And, okay. You know, for me personally, as our legal counsel, who has to put out a lot of work, tell them to donate if they can, if they want to show support.
Well, yeah, the donation stuff is all a given. I mean, that's a regular thing I would do in my radio program. Okay. I was just trying to find some creative ways of trying to make this more interesting, gain your officers that you wanted to,
if they support my client's application and they agree with them, make that be known and spread wherever they can.
Okay.
Make people know and spread it, including their elected politicians.
So Paul and Chris, can I put a sexy cop, and then put go to constitutional.
Well, Chris is not that sexy. So I don't know. We want to stay away.
Oh, come on. I don't know. He's kind of cute. Yeah. They're both gorgeous. Look at him. Yeah.
All right. Let's value the currency here.
That was my question. I think that will help. Thanks, Rocco. I appreciate
it. I'm a part-time comedian myself,
It's been a long time since the Bank of Canada interview. Anyways. Thank you so much again, Rocco, for putting up this.
No problem. You waited so much, I didn't recognize you for a second.
Oh, yeah? Oh, my God. talking to a gay man.
Anybody else? Yeah, sorry.
Jason, you're on. Go ahead.
Okay. Rocco, can you take us through the next steps? You filed the application.
Filed the notice. We're going to be filing the application record very soon. We've got most of our evidence in tow. So in the next several weeks, we'll file that, and then we'll contact the other side to go before motions, a scheduling judge to work out a timetable for them to file their material and to cross-examine each other. And then for a hearing, I'm hoping, optimistically, late September, early October, we get a full day. I mean, a date. This kind of application typically can take 2, 3, or 4 days of argument.
It, Is this, I mean, so this is a given, it's going to go before a judge, or can the judge just toss the application?
Well, the judge can't. I'm sure that if the government lawyers may say they want to bring a motion to strike because my clients don't have a right to bring this application. Often they do that on willy-nilly basis, but we'll see. I don't see how they're entitled to strike this application. Even if they can, it still requires a court date and full argument on their application, okay? But, you know, we don't live in a system where a judge can just take it and use it for firewood that night. No, they can't arbitrarily.
I know. That's why we hire guys like you who know the law. But last question, I just wanted to...
You never hired me.
You're too expensive.
How do you know? You've never hired me.
I wanted to ask, like, was this closed to select media? And if so, why?
No, we sent out media. Listen, when I filed on July 6, 2020, when I filed the massive roadmap challenge to all the COVID measures, I sent out a full media release, like my old cases where I couldn't move in my office when the media was all stacked. No mainstream media covered that press conference. And somebody I've known very well from CBC told me straight that the CBC ordered their people not to cover anything I do on COVID.
So, and one last question. Do you think that the media, like what responsibility does the media have, you know, at writ large? And how, I mean, do you think that this is sort of forcing the hand that if we maybe got a little bit better coverage from the establishment guys that perhaps you wouldn't be in this position right now?
Well, listen, that's a very complicated question, Jason. Let me say the following, because, you know, we live in different spaces in time. And, you know, when I was growing up, CBC National News, when Peter Mansbridge had a bit more hair, I used to have a nightly viewership of 14, 15 million Canadians, and practically half the population was glued. CBC National News now gets 380,000 people watching, 380,000. The Punjabi, Chinese, and Italian newscasts combined every night receive 6.8 million viewers. So if you want to get your word across to Canadians, broadcast simultaneously in Chinese, in Mandarin, Punjabi, and Italian. So the media, the real media now, are the sheep herders and the kennel owners called social media, Twitter, and all these. So what's mainstream media mean anymore? They have been bought. In 2008, at the yearly press conference roast in Ottawa, and I posted this on Twitter the other day, you know, Trudeau was bragging about the reason, you know, as a joke, but it wasn't a joke, it was serious. The reason they get such good coverage from the mainstream media is because he just gave them $600 million. So CBC gets close to $1.5 billion. We say in our statement of claim, and we sued CBC in our statement of claim because it's a national broadcaster under statutory authority as the national broadcaster paid for by the citizens of Canada. We sued them and we say, quote, in the statement of claim, they're liable because they have been to Justin Trudeau on the COVID file what Pravda was to the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So in a short line, there's only four or five major media, and they've all been bought. $1.5 billion a year for CBC, about $500 million for the other major networks. So, you know, their customers are the same brothel.
Okay. Okay. Some questions from the audience now. All right. So page 60 of the claim talks about crimes against humanity, page 80 and 89, criminal negligence. Why is it not in criminal court instead of civil court?
What claim are you reading from? Not mine, no.
Okay, moving on. Why hasn't Rocco utilized the Bill of Rights as it clearly declares within the Emergencies Act updated April 5th, 2021 that the Act is subject to both the Charter and the Bill?
What Bill of Rights? The Canadian Bill of Rights of 1960 only applies to federal law. The only federal jurisdiction so far exercised in this whole COVID is the Quarantine Act. The jurisdiction over health is strictly provincial. So, you know, if and when we tackle the Quarantine Act, then I will also invoke the Canadian Bill of Rights. The Canadian Bill of Rights does not apply to provincial legislation. The charter applies to both provincial and federal legislation.
Thank you. If we witness a situation where police are assaulting our youth under 12, do we have the right to physically step in to stop the abuse?
Very complicated question. You're asking me for legal advice in the abstract. You know, that is a very, very complex and dangerous question. First of all, you may have walked in into a situation where the police officers are defending themselves. You didn't see the attack. Second of all, you don't know why they're trying to arrest that youth or anybody else. There may be a warrant out for his or her arrest. So, if you intervene, I mean, if the police are beating somebody to a pulp in a situation where there's one lone youth and several police officers, you can intervene verbally and film them. But you always intervene with the police at your own immediate risk. There's a difference between law and reality. Don't forget, they got clubs and guns.
Thank you.
So,
can the legal application be adapted for other provinces?
Generally speaking, because these measures are provincial, I'm filing in Ontario. Except for persuasion as a precedent, they're not legally binding in other provinces. Courts will take cases from other provinces to assist them in interpreting the same issues, but they're not legally bound to follow them.
Thank you. What happens if you win? Will officers who broke the oath be held responsible for their wrongdoings?
Well, again, that's a complicated question because that's all on an individual fact-specific situation. And this is part of what we're trying to point out, and this is part of the problem and how the laws are being directed and forced to be enforced. Not every fact situation warrants the same measure across the board without a tabulation of the facts and the circumstances. This is what the politicians are trying to do, and these police supervisors are trying to do. You know, you need the facts on the ground before you decide how you're going to apply the law. Mm-hmm. But let me say, certainly, if a police officer does something illegal, I invite you to go get a lawyer and sue them. It happens every day. Okay.
Is there a prior legal precedent that may be relevant to this case?
Again, there's tons of legal cases that'll be applied to this case. I mean, literally hundreds, but the notice of application covers a comprehensive garden. So there'll be a lot of cases that apply, all the cases delineating section 2, 7, 8, 9, and 15 charter rights will all apply.
So would you say this is a completely new infringement in Canadian history?
Well, to my knowledge, this is the first time that police officers holding office to Her Majesty have actually gone to court against the legislative and executive branch of the government, saying that the laws of the executive and legislative branch of the government that they are being asked and are under a duty to enforce, in fact, violate not only their oath and their duty and their office, but the Constitution. This is the first in Canadian history. I'm sure it's the first anywhere. Mm-hmm.
Can you just remind people how many active and retired?
On the application?
Yeah.
There's 15 active and 4 retired police officers who are specifically named. Some of them have been named as John and James Doe because they're young in their career or because they have families to support and they're afraid of immediate repercussions in terms of being fired.
Mm-hmm. And if more officers want to join the application, is that an option?
That could be an option. There's different procedural ways of doing it. We could file a second parallel application and have them joined at the same time, assuming that they catch up in time.
Gotcha. All right, those were a lot of the questions from the audience. All right.
Well, I'm just curious, you know, we've had...
David, before you ask the question, I can recommend that a good haberdasher or two for your hat. You need one. You know, I'll tell you what, not to try to bribe you, but I will put... I get mines out of New York because I have a skin problem.
Yeah.
But they're, you know,
I'll trade this hat.
Tell Ezra.
Esposito hockey jerseys.
Okay. Okay. Tell Ezra to foot for a better hat. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious. We've had 13 months of what I would call indoctrination propaganda from government officials, bureaucrats, unelected, not accountable health officials that have all kinds of new powers that we've seen. The mainstream media. What I'm getting at, it's clear everybody in this room cares about our constitutional rights and freedoms, but I wonder if the population at large, given all this indoctrination for more than a year, do you get the sense that they are as offended to see our rights trampled upon, or are they actually buying into, well, you know what, it's a pandemic, it's a potentially deadly virus, if it means amputating some of our rights for the greater good, so be it. What would you say to that?
I'll say two or three things to that, David. Okay, so what is the conflict that's happening here, right? On the one hand, you get people for whatever reason, a lot of them for fear, saying we got to do whatever they tell us to do, otherwise we're all going to die tomorrow. Okay, so I'm looking for Chicken Little, nowhere to be found. On the other hand, you have people like my client who are saying, listen, our constitutional freedoms, which are nothing more than human attributes given to us by the creator, even if you believe the creator goes no farther than your mother, the right to think, the right to express, the right to associate, the right, these aren't rights, these are attributes of what it means to be human. Liberty, security of the person, another attribute. Equality of treatment, right? So you say to yourself, okay, on the one side of the balance, you say freedom. Freedom from what? From removal of our human attributes. They're dehumanizing us. And on the other side, you have a lot of things happening. One, you got a fascist agenda for economic retooling of the world. But most of the population, I think, that doesn't have the wherewithal to parse the science, to parse the medicine, to parse the law, is afraid. Now, is the mathematical equation between freedom and fear? Fear is the one single thing that removes freedom. If you're afraid at any level, the most mundane, if you're afraid to say something, you're not free from political correctness, or you're not free to speak. So, and if you're afraid that you got to lock yourself up in the vault because the germ is going to get you and you're afraid of dying from the germ, well, that's another level of fear. But fear removes freedom at every level. And so I think that's what's happening. And fear is mostly, when we talk about fear, fear is all based on one thing. Ignorance of what's actually going on. If you know, then you're not going to be afraid, because then you could take a sober, calculated decision with respect to your life. The reason the fear and the frenzy is so heightened is because people out there don't know. When an official says, you know, this is the way it is, they want to believe it. Because if they knew any better, they'd say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense to me. So you ask yourself, why is it that Tam and Davila and Williams and Bonnie Henry, they never parade their science team and say, here's why we're taking this action. Here is the science. And I'll tell you why they won't. Because the rest of the scientific community would laugh them out of town. They don't want to discuss the rational scientific basis for engendering this fear. Okay?
One last question to the officers, if I may. We were last Saturday in Peterborough, Ontario. There was a large anti-lockdown protest. We had an ex-member of parliament there, Maxime Bernier, leader of the People's Party of Canada, an elected MPP, Randy Hillier. And when they literally giving speeches in the shadow of the Cenotaph at Confederation Park, where commemorates all the men who gave their lives enshrining our freedoms. And when they left the park, the Peterborough police gave these elected representatives tickets for essentially speaking in a public park.
And, you know, it was a bizarre situation because these very same police officers, including the chief of Peterborough Police, Gilbert Scott, last summer, not only turned a blind eye to Black Lives Matter demonstrators in the same park, but actually took a knee. How are we supposed to interpret this kind of hypocrisy, this kind of cherry picking in terms of what is an appropriate protest and what is a protest that brings even elected members of parliament a ticket?
I think I can speak for my clients on that. It's in the notice of application. That's what I was reading from. These things are so vague and non-precise that they are what you want them to be at a different juncture, okay? And so this is a problem for the rule of law. You don't dispatch officers with that kind of vague, imprecise, convenient way of applying the law. And it's political. That's even worse. So we're in a situation, David, where we're in a tyrannical, and people criticize me for saying this, but you know, I had a father survive the camps, Mussolini's camps. We're in the Fourth Reich. This is what happened in Germany and Italy in the late 30s. This is what this looked like. Okay? It starts this way. And so the law should be there more or less clear so that people know the limits of what they can do, including police officers. Yeah. You're going to tase a kid who's skating on a pond because you're protecting him from the COVID virus? You're going to beat a guy, seven officers beating a guy to a pulp in Montreal because he didn't have a mask in the park? You've seen those pictures of the Gestapo on Jewish merchants and Jews in the streets in Germany? That's what I was reminded of. You know, on and on. The OPP shoots dead a man after a high-speed chase because he had an argument with a grocery clerk in a supermarket. This is what we've come to. And that's why these police officers are, it's shocking their conscience as it should. It's shocking their oath as it should. It's shocking the idea of the rule of law in a constitutional democracy as it should, you know? And they're asking us to wear the leather boots and goose step. Well, a lot of us are not going to do it.
Thank you. Questions. So we have about 10 more minutes-ish. Is there a court date?
Well, no, because we just issued the notice of application. There will be a court date within 2 months.
Thank you. Do courts carry on should martial law be enacted, or will this get shelved?
I don't know what that question means. I mean, if martial law prevails, the courts will be meaningless. I don't know that that's going to happen. I hope not, because then it's the law of the jungle, you know.
Thank you. And so this former question is coming from Lawrence, and he says, to clarify, if I gather a number of police officers in BC, would you be willing to let us use your application as written, obviously adapted, for a reasonable fee?
Well, call me and let's talk. I've got three cases going on in the BC courts over the COVID measures, so adding a fourth wouldn't be much.
Okay, aside from the constitutional issues, the misuse of the faulty PCR test to inflate the cases, even if the court found the measures were constitutional, would the evidence on PCR testing undermine the government measures from a scientific standpoint?
If you read the notice of application, we have a direct challenge to the fraudulent use of the PCR tests in this case and every other case I'm carrying. We have two of the experts we have, which are PCR experts. And so we're going to be tackling, because the PCR test is the crucible that fires up and ferments the cases. But as my mother would say, what the do the cases mean, right? What the frigging do they mean? And they're meaningless. I can digress into the evidence, but in terms of ICU beds and hospitals, and your governments are lying to you. We have 384 hospitals in Ontario. We have 2,300 ICU beds. That means we only have 6 ICU beds per hospital. And a year ago, Dougie, Mr. Crybaby Ford, said he was going to double or triple that. He hasn't done any such thing. And so he says, they said 2 days ago, there are 875 ICU COVID patients. Well, that means divided by 384 beds, there are 2.278 COVID patients per hospital in Ontario. They say there are 589 on ventilators of that 875. Well, that means there are 1.5 patients per hospital in Ontario. So what's the problem? Well, they say we only have 2,300 beds and the other 1,400 are being occupied by non-COVID patients. My question, Mr. Ford, is just curious, how many of those 400 non-COVID ICU patients got there after they took the vaccine? And why have you spent $2 billion on PCR testing, useless PCR testing? With $200 billion, you could have built 20 $100 million COVID or pandemic hospitals across the province to deal with this pandemic and the future ones if they come. But what are you doing? You're playing politics. Somebody is making money on all these sticky decals on the sidewalk and in the stores. Somebody's making money on all this shice that doesn't deal with the pandemic. Somebody's making a lot of money putting independent businesses out of business. Somebody's making a lot of money ensuring that teachers, doctors, and police officers become irrelevant. So I now forget the question, I'm sorry. I'm type 2 diabetic, my blood sugar. Two more questions, go ahead.
Has the affidavits for service been filed with the court?
No, we just served. So they'll be filed in the next few days.
Thank you. Do COVID-19 regulations violate the Nuremberg Code against forced medical procedures?
Of course they do.
Is Canada legally obligated to uphold the Nuremberg trial rulings? If yes, through what international enforcement mechanisms?
The three cases, one of which I co-counseled on in 1999, Baker, Hape, and de Guzman in the Federal Court of Appeal. The Supreme Court of Canada has ruled that rights under international treaty or conventions become the minimal, if they're human rights, become the minimal Section 7 charter rights that are to be read in. So yes, through that ruling and through the jurisprudence, if you have an international right against forced medical experimentation or procedure, which is found both in the Nuremberg Code and the Helsinki Declaration of 1960, which is directed at doctors, then you have that right under Section 7 of the Charter here. Furthermore, the Supreme Court of Canada, quite apart from that international dimension, has ruled quite clearly in the Jehovah's Witness cases that your right to refuse medical procedure or treatment without informed consent is constitutionally protected under Section 7. The Ontario Court of Appeal ruled that many decades ago, saying that you can't even inject a violent psychiatric patient to calm him down. If that patient doesn't want to be injected, you can restrain him. So that with the law is quite clear that they can't force you to get the vaccine. They can't force you to take the test, but they can coerce you. The law is equally clear that if you have no duty to mandatory compliance, coercion towards mandatory compliance just converts it into mandatory compliance. So it's like saying if you arrest somebody and you're holding them for questioning and you read them their rights and you say, you don't have to talk to us, but if you don't, we're never letting you out of this jail cell. Well, whatever confession you make ain't voluntary, is it? And so it's the same with medical procedure and treatment. Okay. So again, I want to thank everybody for allowing me to bore the bejesus out of them. We at the Constitutional Rights Center thank you for your support. We seek only a civil, calm, sober discussion, debate, and adjudication of the law, right? And those who have a problem with that, my father used to have a one word name for that, fascist. I get a lot of hate mail because I'm going to court over these issues. You know, you listen to yourselves. You know, my clients, I commend them, and I thank you for your support of the Constitutional Rights Center. thank you for supporting Wholehearted Media, and you know, kudos to my you know, my partner here, Raji Kadli. Putting these things together is not easy. It takes a lot of energy, and you know, and often it's no good deed goes unpunished, but we do what we do because we need to do it. Otherwise we cease being human and we cease being governed by the rule of law. So thank you very much. See you next time.